This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
They've destroyed our lives. They've destroyed our livelihoods. We had nothing. There was nothing to share with family. There was nothing to enjoy.
That's the head of the Teachers Union of Zimbabwe blaming the government for failing to support teachers adequately. Details coming up. Also, the remaining 400 Zimbabwean refugees in Botswana will return home in the coming days. And the Arab League Council will hold an extraordinary meeting in Cairo to discuss the latest developments in Libya. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Malawi is distributing personal security alarms to people with albinism, a condition that causes whitening of the skin from lack of pigmentation. Authorities hope the alarms will protect albinos from attacks by people who believe their body parts have magical powers. But the alarms have only a limited range, raising doubts about their effectiveness. Lamek Masina reports from Lilongwe.
Venda Chipitilo Laston was nearly abducted in March by three men pretending to be police officers. The men said they were searching houses of villagers suspected of keeping albino body parts, which are used across East Africa for so-called black magic. Laston was saved when the men failed to produce identity cards, and villagers handed them over to the real police. He says, "I realized that I can be killed any day because of the way those people came. I was extremely terrified, and I realized that I am being stalked. So since that time, I still live in fear." Police say at least 25 albinos have been killed in Malawi since 2014, and albino graves are often robbed, not of jewelry, but of bodies. So-called witch doctors use the bodies in potions or rituals believed to bring good luck, love, or wealth. Malawi authorities this year reacted to public pressure by distributing mobile personal security alarms to the country's estimated 10,000 albinos. Mary Navicha is the Minister of Gender and Disability.
As government, we are trying to create a conducive environment for the persons with albinism. That's why we are distributing security gadgets for them to be protected and for them to be safe in their communities.
Malawi's albinos initially refused the alarms when first offered in May because authorities stamped them as being a gift from President Peter Mutharika. The alarm sound is activated when the wearer pulls a safety pin, but can only be heard within a range of about 100 meters. Sherif Kaisi, political scientist at Blantyre International University, doubts the effectiveness of the sound.
The sound that it produces, you can agree with me that it's not that sound that can so alarming that people can say there is something happening. And it is not in our tradition as Malawians, in many cases, that when we hear the sound or the alarm, people start rushing to see what is happening over there.
Malawi police and local leaders are trying to educate people to react to any alarms. Laston says he feels a little safer with the alarm on, but the limited range deters him from traveling to earn money, so he is struggling to put food on the table. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Lilongwe.
The Arab League Council will hold an extraordinary meeting in Cairo on Tuesday to discuss the latest developments in Libya. Egypt requested the meeting with the aim of taking a unified stance against illegitimate interference in Libya and exploring means of settling the crisis there. France and Egypt on Monday called for the greatest restraint by Libyan and international authorities to avoid escalating the conflict. French President Emmanuel Macron and Egyptian counterpart Abdel Fattah al-Sisi agreed that warring Libyan powers need to negotiate a political solution under UN auspices. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan expressed readiness to quickly send troops to Libya to fend off the campaign of strongman Khalifa Haftar and his self-styled Libyan National Army against the UN-backed Government of National Accord, GNA, in Tripoli. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed the latest developments in Libya with Wolfgang Poshtai, security and policy analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations.
I'm sure this would certainly not be a game changer for Libya, but the intention of the Egyptians and from the other countries initiating this meeting is probably to demonstrate Turkey that the Arab world is united against any Turkish intervention in Libya. And I would say probably with the exception of Qatar and some African states, this could be true. So depending on the final statement of the meeting, this could be a very strong voice to explain Turkey better stay at home.
France and Egypt called Monday for the greatest restraint by Libyan and international authorities to avoid escalating the conflict in Libya. Macron and his Egyptian counterpart, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, agreed that warring Libyan powers need to negotiate a political solution under UN auspices. Could Egyptian-European pressure prevent the imminent Turkish intervention in Libya?
I would not rule this entirely out. This is, again, like the Egyptian initiative with regard to the Arab League, about demonstrating Turkey that the disadvantages of such an intervention would be certainly larger than the advantages anticipated by Turkey. Egypt also wants to make clear by these statements that they will certainly intervene openly, this is about an open intervention, in the case there is an open Turkish military intervention in Libya. And as vital national Egyptian interests would be affected by a Turkish intervention in Libya, this is also somehow understandable. Egypt intends to prevent an Islamist-dominated state in Libya by all means, including military means. They consider this not a war of choice, but a war of necessity, as they consider this as a lethal threat to Egypt. They consider Erdogan a support of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood is the arch enemy of the government in Egypt. So the pieces fit together that Egypt considers this as a war of necessity, and this is extremely dangerous.
But Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan expressed readiness to quickly send his troops to Libya to fend off the campaign of strongman Khalifa Haftar against the Government of National Accord in Tripoli. Would Turkey do that, and what are the possible scenarios?
This is still very likely. One of the purposes of the recently deployed Syrian fighters in Libya is to stabilize the front lines and to prepare the ground for a deployment of Turkish assets. Those Turkish assets would most likely not be some kind of infantry or tanks or something like this. This would be more likely air defense, modern precision-guided artillery, jammers and advanced reconnaissance assets, as well as logistics. Eventually, they would also fly a few airstrikes on LNA air bases, for example, on Al Jufra or Al Wadiya. And one thing is sure, the LNA will certainly not be a match for the Turkish army. So this would certainly drag the Egyptian armed forces into the war in Libya. And let me be clear, this is not, or better, not only about Libya anymore. This is really about a likely full-fledged regional escalation. And this is what's really the worrying on this.
UN-sponsored talks on the Libyan conflict are set for January in Berlin to try to end the fighting. What could be expected from such talks while the Libyan rivals are involved in fierce fighting?
For the time being, nothing could be expected from these kind of talks. It is also not likely that there will be any kind of success until not at least a ceasefire would be on the horizon. And right now, both sides still think that with their external supporters, they're able to win. The GNA supporters still hope that the Libyan National Army will break up sooner than later. And on the other side, the LNA still believes that they are able to take Tripoli in the next days or weeks. So the prospects for such a conference are dire. And I think the Germans are aware of this, and I think it's unlikely that such a conference will take place before there is a real chance for a success.
And that was Wolfgang Poshtai, security and policy analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. The remaining 400 Zimbabwean refugees in Botswana will return home in the coming days after registering for voluntary repatriation. The Botswana government had given the refugees a year-end deadline to register or risk forced removal. But some, mostly those who fled political violence, are reluctant to return. From Habrone, Mokandisi Dube reports.
The first group of 135 Zimbabwean refugees was repatriated in mid-December. The Botswana government gave the migrants an ultimatum to register by December 31 for voluntary repatriation or their first deportation. Most of the remaining 400 refugees have registered for repatriation and will leave Botswana next week. This refugee who did not want to give her name did so reluctantly.
There was no option but to register for the repatriation. Otherwise, they were going to force us out. If you are deported, you know you live with nothing, no money, no property. It is not that we really want to return home.
However, some have asked to be allowed to remain in Botswana or to be sent to third countries rather than to return home. Wasu Chibi, who supported the opposition MDC before fleeing to Botswana a decade ago, says it is unsafe to return.
I was not brought into Botswana. I was not given any money to come to Botswana. With money or without money, I am in Botswana to stay. No matter deportation, no matter force, no matter what.
Begimpilo Weza, another MDC member, prefers to be transferred to a third country if he cannot remain in Botswana.
If you remember when we received here in Botswana, this was regarded a political crisis. So when it is over, people should come to an agreement. They should come to a cessation clause whereby all international community bodies, human rights organizations will agree that really the country is safe for return.
The final repatriations are expected to begin this week, with each migrant receiving $300 as a settlement allowance. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Habrone, Botswana.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Seventeen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Malawi is distributing personal security alarms to people with albinism to protect albinos from attacks. And the Arab League Council holds a meeting on Tuesday in Cairo to discuss the latest developments in Libya. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. It's been a sad festive season in Zimbabwe, marked by economic decline, rising inflation, and stagnant salaries. Schools will open for another term soon, a burden to parents who will have to pay school fees and buy supplies. Complicating the situation, teachers warn they will not be present when schools open in January. Reporter Kuzai Zanawashi has more.
Opet Masaraure says the festive season has just been another season of suffering in Zimbabwe.
The festive season for us really was a reminder that the government of Zimbabwe, they've destroyed our lives, they've destroyed our livelihoods. We had nothing, there was nothing to share with family, there was nothing to enjoy, there was nothing festival about that this season.
Masaraure is the head of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe. He says teachers earned the equivalent of $30 in December. That salary is so low, basic commodities were beyond the reach of many. Masaraure warns teachers will not be able to go to work when schools open in January.
Even if they wanted to go back, it's not possible. No one can be able to go back to work under the obtaining circumstances. We are glad that the members of our organization have declared openly that they are not going to participate in any teaching until their salaries have been reviewed.
He adds that other teachers' unions have joined in and will stand together in pressuring the government to review their salaries. Tulani Mswelando is the director of an organization called Crisis in Zimbabwe Coalition. He says government should tie salaries to the poverty line.
Salaries must be pegged beyond the poverty line. We believe that civil servants have not yet been capacitated by the government. The government is simply reneging on salaries. We appeal to both the government to provide adequate remuneration to civil servants so that we do not have current prevailing crisis.
Gideon Rubatika is a father of three who sympathizes with teachers.
Looking at the situation, they are getting paltry salaries and they cannot even afford a decent living. And yet as parents, we are expecting that they give our children a decent education, but it's not possible.
He adds that underpaid and demotivated teachers will not be able to provide students a quality education. Union leader Masaraure says the salary issue has come up repeatedly, and his union now is committed to finding a long-lasting solution this time around. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
The World Health Organization says East Africa has the highest rate of cervical cancer in the world. In October, Kenya launched a mass vaccination of girls against the human papillomavirus, HPV, which can lead to cervical cancer. The vaccine is being welcomed by HPV patients who hope their children will be protected better than they were. Rael Ambor reports from Nairobi.
30-year-old Jacinta Agunja tested positive in 2016 for one of the human papillomaviruses that lead to cervical cancer. After 2 years of intensive and expensive treatment, she was free of HPV and did not get cancer. Agunja hopes Kenya's mass vaccination of girls, launched in October, will prevent her 10-year-old daughter from also getting the virus.
That vaccine, I just need it to help my daughter and other women who are not sexually active for now. When they come to be sexually active, they'll be already protected, so they cannot go through what I went through. Because most of women in informal settlement, they cannot afford that much.
Kenya is offering the free HPV vaccine as part of the country's routine immunization schedule to 10-year-old girls. Doctors say the vaccine program is a major milestone in the fight against cervical cancer in East Africa, which has the highest rate in the world. Dr. Catherine Nyongesa is the director of the Texas Cancer Center, a private hospital started in 2010 to offer specialized cancer treatment.
Parents are encouraged to take their children for immunization, but all the same, a vaccination doesn't give one guarantee that you may not get the cancer, but studies in developed countries have shown that actually the rate of cervical cancer goes down with planned proper immunization.
At least 7 women die every day in Kenya from cervical cancer, according to the Ministry of Health. The ministry says the HPV vaccine could cut the rate of cervical cancer by up to 70%. Cecily Karioki is Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Health.
We have managed to distribute the vaccines in all the 47 counties, in all the public facilities. We have covered upwards of 300,000 girls to date. The target continues because our target is 800,000 girls.
At least 115 countries have made the HPV vaccine routine, including some in East Africa. Rwanda first introduced the vaccine in 2006, followed by Uganda in 2015 and Tanzania in 2018. While Kenya normally leads development in the region, its efforts in preventing cervical cancer are seen by many, including Agunja, as better late than never. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Wheelchair basketball is growing in popularity in South Sudan, offering hope for athletes with disabilities, some of whom lost legs from unexploded ordnance left from decades of conflict. U.S. professional wheelchair basketball players, including Sudanese-American Malat Hui, this month helped 80 South Sudanese players take part in a week-long training program and tournament. Sheila Pony reports from Juba.
Malat Hui is a wheelchair athlete who lost the use of his legs to polio in South Sudan when he was only 3 years old. When Malat was 12, after living in a refugee camp for several years, his family moved to the United States, where he eventually played wheelchair basketball at the University of Arizona. In December, He returned to South Sudan as a role model for other disabled athletes.
I went through the same time, the same situation that these athletes are going through. So, as of me, coming back, it's a hope for them, saying that there are someone that actually care about us.
This month, Malat helped train 80 South Sudanese wheelchair basketball players for a two-day competition in Juba. The training was organized by the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, and the South Sudan Wheelchair Basketball Association. Wei says that in 2 years, the number of players has more than doubled. And this year, 15 women were included for the first time. Anna Doki Gabriel, who has never played basketball before, talked about the goal of this training and competition. She says, "For me as a person in a wheelchair, basketball has really made me feel that we can do something just like able-bodied people." Conflict and poverty in South Sudan have marginalized more than 1.2 million people with disabilities, including some who lost legs from an exploded ordnance remaining after decades of conflict. Disability and Inclusion Advisor for the ICRC, Jesse Mark, has trained wheelchair teams in Afghanistan, the Middle East, and South America. He says the training works to change negative perceptions of people with disabilities.
Once they start to have that confidence in themselves and they start to realize that maybe what they've always been told about what their place in society should be is not what their place in society should be. They should expect more from themselves and from the society around them.
Malatwe says inclusion and acceptancy isn't all these athletes learn.
These athletes, they're all from different tribes, from different backgrounds, But when they come to the basketball court, the sport just brings this joy of all the South Sudanese uniting together and to collaborate and to work together as one country.
He says that is something his country needs right now. Sheila Aponi for VOA News, Juba.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa. The Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hi, my name is Larry London. Tune in on January 3rd at 1500 Universal for an interesting program on border crossings featuring the songs With Time in the title. It's the new year, 2020 is here, and we'll be playing songs from Michael Jackson, Ariana Grande, Justin Bieber, all the hits with the word time in the title. See you at 1500 Universal on January 3rd, right here on Border Crossings.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.